This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. There are now more than 28,000 people in Massachusetts who have tested positive for coronavirus and almost 1,000 deaths. According to state data, about half of the state's hospital beds are now full as we've entered the window of time in which medical leaders say coronavirus cases should be surging. For an on-the-ground perspective, we're joined by Dr. Sharon Wright. She's the Senior Medical Director of the Division of Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Dr. Wright, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Wright, Governor Baker is predicting a peak in cases of COVID-19 around April 20th. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh has said his modeling shows a peak in Boston around the 26th. What are you seeing in your hospital right now?
You know, I think it's so hard to predict, but we have been seeing increases more over last week than this week, and now it's been a slower but steady continued increase. We are definitely, I think, not feeling the full surge yet. Not totally clear when we will, but we're seeing, more critically ill patients and more patients overall.
And how are you and your colleagues faring right now with this slow, steady increase?
You know, I think it's been a long number of weeks, and there's going to be more coming. I think, the healthcare providers and the whole healthcare community have been standing up really well, I couldn't say that we're not all tired, I'm impressed every day by all the hard work that everyone at our hospital and all the hospitals in town really are putting forward to protect patients and protect themselves as best as they can.
We've all been watching the status of personal protective equipment from the very beginning of this. As of now, do you and your colleagues have enough PPE?
I would say that it's better. It's definitely a shifting landscape. I think, as you know, Battelle, which is a company from Ohio, has come and stood up an operation in Somerville, which will help reprocess and decontaminate N95 respirators, but there's so much more to PPE than that. You know, at the IDMC and across Beth Israel Lahey Health, we have been standing up ways to do our own reprocessing in addition to utilizing Battelle and other means. But we still try to get as much new PPE as we can, both through purchase and through donations and innovation. I think in terms of face shields, we're in a much better place. In N95s and surgical masks, we're doing okay. But now gowns are an issue. And so I think it's always something. We're trying to be creative in the ways that we try to fix this and protect our staff.
What other kinds of measures is the hospital taking to try to stop the spread of the virus within the hospital?
Well, within the hospital, we rely largely on personal protective equipment, but also, I think since the last time we spoke, our testing capacity is much increased. We're doing testing at BIDMC for the entire Beth Israel Lahey Health System. And so we have been able to, through a lot of work from many people in the lab, as well as some folks through innovation, have been creating test kits and been able to do more testing so we can identify more patients. We've also created a number of cohort units, and I think at least at the medical center, we have had to create surge units where we have been putting patients who have either confirmed or suspected COVID-19 together on units, and we've even had to flex up with making what's traditionally a medical surgical unit, because it's one of our largest units, into an ICU, and kind of buddied up ICU nurses and med-surg nurses together in that space. We've had to do things like retrofit the doors of the patient rooms that are normally solid wood with windows so that we can more safely care for patients, and we're utilizing things like iPads more in the care of patients. So trying to be creative in the way that we can provide safe care to our patients.
I know that regardless, it can be dangerous for the medical staff there. According to the most recent data sent to WBUR, 159 staff at Beth Israel Deaconess have tested positive. One, I'm sorry, that's a lot of people, and I know that must be a stressful and scary situation there. I wondered if you could put that in context for us. We've heard in the past that actually many people who are in healthcare who have contracted coronavirus actually got it through community spread, not necessarily through their work. Do you know in the case of Beth Israel?
I can tell you that at least through discussions with our employee health folks. And obviously, anytime that we have a case in the medical center of a patient or a staff member who turns positive while they're at the medical center, we look to see could it have been acquired at the hospital or not. And most cases in our healthcare providers have likely been community exposures, meaning that they generally know someone who's either been ill or had confirmed COVID or is being worked up for COVID. So I think that's true at Beth Israel Deaconess the same way it is at most hospitals. And it's just unfortunate that there's so much in the community that, you know, I think we all get exposed more than we realize.
You mentioned earlier that we talked a couple weeks ago. We did. It was 3 weeks ago. Radio Boston was, we were doing our doctor call-ins, if you recall, when people would phone with their general questions about the virus because everything was so new. A lot has changed in those 3 weeks, including what we know about the virus and how it spreads. What would you say we know now that we didn't when we first talked to you?
I think that we know a little bit more now that there is a role that's probably a little bit bigger than it is for other respiratory viruses like influenza for either what I would call pre-symptomatic, so people before they're showing symptoms but about to become symptomatic, and asymptomatic people or people with atypical symptoms. And so that seems to be playing a bigger role, I think, than we realize, though it's still not totally clear how much those folks who are asymptomatic are shedding viable and transmissible virus. But we do think that's playing more of a role. And I think that changes the way that we think about using our testing and the way that we look at people who are interfacing with our facilities.
Can you tell us a little more about that, how it has changed those things?
Well, some of it is also just because our capacity to test has gotten a lot better. But I would say that it makes us think a little bit harder, whereas we may have come down more strongly that we were not testing people who are asymptomatic. And I still have to think about how that makes sense, because we know that people who have symptoms are more likely to have a positive test, not just because they're more likely to have COVID, but just because the test performs better, since it's a test that, you know, a swab goes into your nasopharynx, so in through your nose towards the back of your throat to get a specimen, and it's basically testing respiratory secretions. And so someone who's asymptomatic has less of those cells and may be more less likely to have a positive test. And so it's hard to know what to make of testing large numbers of people who are asymptomatic, but I think there's more and more data coming out that testing women who are going to be delivering maybe within the next week, even if they're asymptomatic, thinking about high-risk surgical procedures and maybe other surgical procedures, people coming in from certain congregate settings, maybe like nursing homes, shelters, prisons, where they can't do the kind of social distancing that's being recommended as easily. And so for all of those places, we're thinking more about whether we should be just focusing on people with symptoms.
So a group of researchers at Harvard University's T.H. Chan School of Public Health came out with some research yesterday. It warned that the U.S. may need to practice periodic social distancing through 2022. I've seen a lot of very strong reactions from people in social media about that. Yeah. In your opinion, is that a scenario we should be preparing for?
It's hard to know. I think 2022 seems like a long time away.
But yes,
on the other hand, maybe it's not. I think that it is true that, you know, social distancing can only play so much. And at some point, until we have a vaccine, when we start trying to return to some degree of normalcy and getting back to work or school, that more people will be exposed. And we may see another peak because we won't have a vaccine until 12 to 18 months. And so until we have to develop immunity somehow, either through a vaccine or through herd immunity, meaning enough of the population being exposed. Unfortunately, that means more people will get sick. And so we will see, I think, maybe the ebb and flow of the illness until we can get some real protection.
I want to shift gears for just a second, because today is also the 7th year anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombing. And I just wondered how you're reflecting on that crisis now as a healthcare provider, given that we're in the midst of another and so different of one.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually thinking about that when I was driving into work this morning. And I think that, you know, I took care of some of those patients, and I was fortunate enough to get to know them and spend some time with them. And, you know, that's a very different type of a crisis. But the fact that those two periods of time are kind of coming together at the anniversary made me think about how strong the Boston community as a whole is, and how folks have really come together to help take care of their neighbors and healthcare workers taking care of each other and patients in a similar way. This is, you know, I think this is what we do. There's, you know, it's causes anxiety and it makes people really consider the situations we put ourselves in. But I think in the end, everyone really seems to be standing up and doing the right thing to help each other.
And Dr. Wright, where are you finding hope and encouragement right now?
I think, you know, with some of the research that's coming out so quickly and people being willing to share their data and share findings, I'm on a number of listservs where people are sharing things that they find out and protocols that they come up with even before they're really fully vetted, just so people can learn from other people's experience. I think, you know, the ways that neighbors are standing up for each other, the ways that healthcare workers have been working so many long hours for so many weeks now, just trying to help and take care of patients in the best way that they can. I think those are the things that give me hope at the end of a long day.
Dr. Sharon Wright, Senior Medical Director of the Division of Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Thanks for taking time out of what must be a crazy life right now to talk with us on Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. We're nearing 1,000 deaths in Massachusetts due to the coronavirus. Over 26,000 people have died in the United States. One of the people who's passed away from COVID-19 is Peter Coogan. He died Thursday. He was 76 years old. Coogan lived in Newton Center with his wife, Deborah Coogan. He was also born in Newton. He was a lawyer, educated at Harvard, and he practiced law for 37 years at the firm Foley Hoag. Coogan had been living in a nursing home for the past 14 months. Earlier today, we reached Debbie Coogan to talk about her husband and how she's doing since last Thursday.
I'm doing as fine as I can possibly be. It is dreadful, and I feel for all of those people who, like me, have lost someone and yet can't be with family and friends.
You and Peter were together for 45 years. Tell us about him.
We had a wonderful marriage. I was so lucky. To have met him, and I fell in love with him right away. He was just a wonderful human being.
What caught you about him? Can you remember one of the first things?
Oh, gosh. I'm not sure that I could. I found him so interesting, and he enlarged my world. He introduced me to opera and classical music, and he had a home in a vacation home in Vermont, and we would go there and cut down trees and split wood for firewood. There were just so many things that I never experienced until I was with him.
How long had Peter been in the nursing home when he contracted the virus, Debbie? And do you know how it happened?
He was in the nursing home for over 14 months. The nursing home did a wonderful job of trying to protect the patients. But it's inevitable that the virus was going to get into the nursing home, since there's no foolproof way of screening the workers. So I guess I knew it was inevitable, but I didn't think it would happen.
Before the pandemic, before the changes in visitation, et cetera, what was the rhythm of your life like with Peter once you went into the nursing home? How often did you see him? You know, how did you interact with him?
I was there every day. I never missed a day. And I was with Peter 5 to 7 hours a day. He couldn't feed himself. I would feed him lunch and dinner. I would read the newspaper to him, or books or letters. And, you know, one of the ironies of all ironies is we courted before we were married. Over the Watergate hearings, we would come home from work and watch the reruns of the hearings. And here we were in the nursing home watching every minute of the Trump impeachment hearings. Mm. We were together, and I held his hand. I felt so good about that, even though it was so hard to have him in the nursing home and not at home.
So then you weren't able to physically be with him for the month before he passed away or on the day that he died. What must that have been like for you?
It was tough. It was very tough. The worst part, initially, the nursing home was very kind. The administrator and the social worker called me to tell me that they were closing the nursing home to all visitors. And I was just horrified. I was upset. I was weeping. I couldn't imagine being so separated from my husband. But then as time went on and I saw how bad the virus was, how contagious, how dreadful it was, I began to understand why they had done it. I didn't like it. I called Peter four times a day to talk with him. It wasn't the same as my being there, but I understood it just had to be.
And who was there for you during that time?
We have wonderful children. They were so supportive. I have a lot of friends and a lot of relatives who were very caring, but the best and the most helpful were our children.
What did you and Peter talk about, or what did you talk about to Peter on the day he passed away?
The nursing home facilitated FaceTime, and so we had a number of sessions all throughout the day, and both our children and I were able to tell him how much we loved him and how important he was to us and how we cared so much about him. But the best thing, the very best thing, was that we had a birth of our grandson. Our daughter had adopted her first child, who was now 4 years old, and she and her husband were looking to adopt a second child. The baby they got matched with a child. The baby was born on the Sunday before my husband died, and on the day he was dying, the baby was given to our daughter for adoption. So my last FaceTime with my husband, I was able to tell him that we had a second grandchild and that the grandchild had been named in honor of him. That meant so much to me. That meant so much.
You're having to pioneer now a new way of grieving, as so many people are in the middle of this pandemic. What is your process of grief at this time, and is it enough for you? I apologize if that's a dumb question.
No, it's not a dumb question, and I'm sure everybody is feeling the way I am. I think this is horrible. It's necessary. I understand that, but I am so alone. Thank God for FaceTime and Zoom. I am constantly talking on FaceTime with our children and with other family. I'm on the internet with emails. That all helps. That helps so much. But I just wish I could be with my children. I want to give a hug to my children. I want to give a hug to my grandchildren. And it just feels so sad not to be able to do that.
Well, Deborah Coogan, I'm so sorry for your grief, but I'm also so grateful to you for sharing your story with us here. Thanks for joining us on Radio Boston today.
Thank you.
Peter Coogan passed away last Thursday from COVID-19. He was 76 years old. We have a couple of guests joining us now to join us in the conversation we're inviting you to have with us about grief and loss, during this difficult pandemic. With me now is Sari Luderman. She's a grief counselor based in Lexington. Hi, Sari.
Hi, Tiziana.
And also with us is Reverend John Kearns. He's a chaplain at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Hi, John.
Hi, Tiziana. How do I say your name?
You say Tiziana.
Tiziana.
Thanks for asking.
Hello. You're welcome. Thank you.
So I think it was pretty obvious how strongly I reacted to Debbie Coogan during that conversation. And I just wanted to ask you both to reflect on what you heard.
You know, Debbie's loss is a profound one, and I want to sort of extend just my own sort of note of compassion to her, and something that she sort of got on the radio and limbed for us, what her loss has been like, because it's clearly been wrenching and it's very, very recent. And I appreciate that she sounds like highly resilient to me in a number of ways, but you know, we're cut off at the knees in a lot of really meaningful ways right now about how we grieve. And one of the ways that we grieve that is so important is in community. Mm-hmm. It's in community. It's, you know, sitting together, being together. It takes, you know, all different shapes for different people, but just physically having an opportunity to be with our loved ones is a huge way that we cope around loss. And to be denied that is, it kind of boggles my mind a little bit. It's mm-hmm. you know, this, her loss is a very recent one, but I wonder over time what Debbie thinks when she looks back. You know, we're in this right now. What does it look like in the long-term view? I mean, how traumatic will this be? How will this read to her down the road? This is pretty brutal.
Yeah. Yeah. Reverend Kearns.
I would totally agree. And I just noticed how starkly she described the experience of being able to go to the nursing home to see her husband, who had been such a source of kind of an interesting parts of life and really kind of opened her life up in so many ways. And then for her to be with him and support him through the months in the nursing home. And she said that we were together. I held his hand. I felt so good about that. So just what was essential, what was most important in that time. And then with the phone call, which was the worst thing for her, to have that taken away from her, to no longer be able to visit him. And then when she talked about having lost him, that sense of being so alone, right? And so just that stark difference of so not being able to be with him through that time was such a loss even before she lost him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people often find those the most important times and feel a regret if they weren't able to provide that for them. And so that's something I would be concerned about her ongoing grief is, you know, she did everything she could given the difficult situation, but somehow all of us wish we could have done more. And hoping that someone's there to support her through that, to help her understand that she's did everything she possibly could.
So Reverend John Kearns and Sari Luderman, I'm glad to tell listeners that you're going to stay mm-hmm. with us. We're going to take a break in a minute. And mm-hmm. when we come back, we're going to open this up for calls from our listeners. We're taking your calls on how you're grieving our individual and our collective losses at this time. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We want you to share your questions, your thoughts, your reflections. When we come back, I'll have a caller for us right away. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. We've lost nearly 1,000 people in Massachusetts because of COVID-19. Before the break, we heard one of their stories. Earlier today, Governor Baker reflected on what the rising death toll means to him.
When you talk about where the numbers are going on this, what I'm really thinking about is all those people who aren't going to have a chance to say goodbye. And I really hope people have a chance to make sure that they don't leave anything off the table with respect to their loved ones.
We're all thinking about it. So we wanted to ask, how do we grieve in this strange, awful time for the lives we lose, for our collective losses, and how do we say goodbye? We're inviting you to be part of that conversation. Join us at the table, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Before the break, I introduced you to two people who've joined me to help us with this conversation. The first is Sari Luderman. She's a grief counselor based in Lexington. And Reverend John Kearns. He's a chaplain at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Thanks to both of you for staying with us.
You're welcome.
Sure.
And actually, we have calls. I'd like to go straight to a call here. We've got Lauren on the line from Charlestown. Lauren, how are you?
I'm having a hard time. I live in Charlestown. My daughter has the virus in L.A. She's single and alone in her apartment. I lost my aunt last week. She died alone from the virus.
Oh, Lauren.
And my husband died a year and a half ago. So these are secondary losses. Mm. And what no one has addressed is for people, I'm 70, is the financial cutoff at the knees now that I have, because I had money for the rest of my life to stretch out, and now I don't have it. And my daughter has to move, but with the pandemic, she cannot. I can no longer afford where I live, and I'm going to have to move. And my son has to move. So financially, it is, no one is talking about people on fixed incomes that mm-hmm. now their future is mm-hmm. totally different. Mm-hmm. And I have a daughter. I'm not getting texts anymore every day now saying I need help to breathe. But it is, I'm so alone and I'm so isolated and I really wish my husband were here, and I'm not near either of my children. So I'm just stressed all around.
Yeah.
Stay
yeah.
on the line while our guests respond to you, Lauren. Stay with us. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Sari.
You know, Lauren, I appreciate, the agony you must be in. You've limbed a lot of loss in a short period of time, mm-hmm. and all kinds of fear. I mean, of course, mm-hmm. you must be so fearful yeah. about your daughter being so far away and not being yeah. able to help in that way. But what you're naming mm-hmm. is a huge loss, which is security. Financial security is a huge loss. Day-to-day security yeah. that we all took for granted previously about how the day might look and the jobs we might go to has been wiped clean with this, with coronavirus. Yeah. And mm-hmm. it's a profound loss to lose that kind of underpinning and that kind of security at a time when you have so much personal loss. And yeah. to be looking at trying to cope around moving, all that kind of executive function stuff that is mm-hmm. just filled with odds and ends and errands, and just, I'm sure that feels like climbing a mountain to you mm-hmm. right now, just to even yeah. consider it. So I think acknowledging mm-hmm. what you're articulating is the place to start here. We are, I think we're all struggling to come up with tools at this time when we are each so alone in so many ways. I think yeah. that, yeah, community is a binder, and you're very, very alone. And I appreciate that. And I hear what you've said.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Lauren.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So Lauren, call us again. You know, we do call-ins mm-hmm. every day. There will be other yeah. invitations. If you're alone and you're yeah. isolated, call us again. We'll mm-hmm. talk to you. We'll be here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks so much. Okay. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-800-423-8255. Mm-hmm. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To join the conversation like Lauren just did, Barry is on the line. Barry, I think you're out on 495. Is that right?
I am. So I have a job. I deliver meds to assisted living facilities. So I see every day the lockdown facilities and the people who can't get into their parents and the people in the facilities who can't see their families. And my mother passed away in end of January, she was 98, and she had been in memory care unit for, well, the better part of a year, and we watched her decline, and we were the family that we were there, like, all the time. And she passed away at the end of January. We had a funeral. We had the interment. We sat, we're Jewish. We sat Shiva. We had everything we needed to have. And then shortly thereafter, they started doing the lockdowns and all that. And for several weeks, anytime my sister and I would talk on the phone or my kids, the first words out of our mouth would be, "Thank God Mom's dead." Because we would not be able to deal with this. I don't know how people do it.
Yeah. Reverend Kearns.
Yeah.
Thanks, Barry. And Barry, I'm so sorry for your loss. Mm-hmm. I really am. Mm-hmm.
Reverend Kearns. You know, we talk about it. My mother died of being 98. She wasn't sick. She was. She had a great life for the most part. And, you know, it's sad, but not a tragedy.
Right. Barry, I can so appreciate this. What you're saying, I think what you point to, one of the things you point to is the fact that, you know, having an elderly person taken care of and being safe and protected in old age and then dying comfortably and surrounded by loved ones is such a kind of an expected part of our process of escorting elderly and our own loved ones to the next life, including the funeral and the services afterwards. And when those kind of basic fundamental things are deprived of someone, it poses such an incredible loss that even you can feel that loss for others, even though you had it for your mother. And I can relate to the fact I have parents in an assisted living now, and so I cannot visit them. And my dad was hospitalized last week, and my mother was alone, and, you know, not being able to be there for them as I used to be and be able to see them and to, you know, pick up their spirits and check in on them even while hospitalized, it is definitely an incredible burden and source of stress for family members. And so I can really relate to you on that level, too.
Let's go back to Barry. Barry, any closing thoughts as you kind of drive off into the sunset on 495?
No, I'm just, like I said, we were lucky. My mother stayed and was able to hang on to see all of her grandchildren, a couple of her great-grandchildren, and we were good.
Well, thanks for sharing your experience with us, Barry.
Like I said, don't know how people deal with this.
She was lucky to have you, Barry, to have such children that cared so deeply for her. It's such a gift.
Let's take another call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Are you in grief? Are you worried? Have you lost someone? Are you struggling with not being able to mourn them in the way that you're used to? Join our conversation. We have Cindy on the line from Newton. Cindy, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking the call. I've never called in anything like this before, but on Sunday, I lost my uncle. He was my rock of my family. He was the person, my go-to person. He was only 78, and he died in a very freak biking accident. So in this time of COVID, where our families are just spread literally all over the country, how do we somehow get together and feel, you know, and support each other? His wife, my aunt, is seriously ill and compromised, and he was taking care of her every single day. And while they did have caregivers, he was her rock, of course. And she's unable to understand that he's gone. So I am the oldest of the younger generation and trying to cope with this and help my cousins and my siblings and my children deal with such a horrific loss at an unusual time.
Cindy, I know words aren't enough, but I am sorry. It is a horrific loss, and it's such an incredibly difficult time for that to happen. Sari, I imagine what you're hearing from Cindy registers with you, given what you do and the people you support.
Right. Yeah, right. Cindy, you know, I want to first of all just extend my condolences for your suffering. This has got to be impossible right now. And I think you're sort of highlighting for all of us that people are dying lots of different ways right now, and people are grieving all kinds of loss in addition to COVID loss and security loss and all of that. And in some ways, I think what I hear you articulating is you feel almost, it's almost more lonely. It's like your loss feels like a little sort of island loss when everyone else is on this sort of in a different space of loss. And the focal point is so intensely COVID loss. And this is no less profound and sad. And you're also at the mercy of the same kind of limits of not being able to hug people, not being able to be together, not being able to meaningfully commune beyond sort of FaceTime and phone calling and what that can provide. So in some ways you're in a similar situation as everyone else, but in others it's quite different because the feelings that a freak bike accident might bring up might be quite different than some of the experiences we're hearing about COVID loss.
Cindy.
Yeah. It's just a very strange place to be in right now. The only, I can give myself a silver lining and say, my dad died a year and a half ago. So he is now, his brother has just joined him to celebrate his birthday, because today would have been my dad's birthday. So I feel like I look for the good in everything I possibly can. And the fact that my aunt can't understand or grieve for her husband, maybe that's a blessing in a way too. I mean, just trying to make it all better.
Well, Cindy, take care. We'll be thinking of your family. I'm glad you called in and both shared your story and got a chance to get some support from us today. We wish you the best. Take good care.
Thanks,
Reverend Kearns. Reverend Kearns, I want to play a moment from Governor Baker, actually, today. There was a remarkable minute in his press briefing where he got emotional while reflecting on individual losses we're suffering. So here he is. He's talking about the loss of his friend's mother. And don't be surprised by the pause in the sound you're going to hear.
My best friend lost his mom to COVID. And he and his mom had a great relationship. And because they had a great relationship, they never left anything unsaid. I mean, you just knew that about the two of them, that this wasn't going to be one of those situations where, you know, oh my gosh, I wish I'd had the chance to tell her whatever, or to tell my son whatever. I mean, that never happened with them. But that didn't make the fact that it was an extraordinarily painful process for their family to go through this loss of a critical ritual that people believe in and hold on to, that's this chance to say goodbye.
Reverend Kearns, I feel like we're hearing that from Barry. We're hearing that from Cindy. It is remarkable to have a public leader expressing grief in that way. Yes. How right now can people say goodbye when so many of our rituals for saying goodbye aren't available to us?
Well, it's an excellent question. And earlier when you asked us to reflect on what we heard, I heard that same kind of pause from you. when you were talking to Debbie, right, that depth of really resonance with the sadness and the tragedy in all of this, And just kind of, I think, naming that up front is just so important. I find here in the hospital setting, you know, something we are doing is being able to bring an iPad into the patient and so they can connect with their loved one, or at least the loved one can see them and speak to them before they go. I was asked to say a prayer for a family, a prayer of peace for the person who was going to die. They couldn't come in. They had a friend come in to see the person, but they wanted from me a prayer of peace for him. And so praying that prayer of peace is a way of helping families, you know, letting go and saying goodbye. But I know that that important work of saying goodbye and, you know, asking and giving forgiveness and thanking someone and expressing your love for them is so critical. And we are discovering here, as I think our whole society is, new ways of doing that. And so through the iPhone, and through iPad, here at the hospital, the virtual intercom system, and Zoom, people reaching out to each other. We need ways to do that. And I just recognize again, Debbie, at the beginning, how she missed not being able to give a hug, that human contact. And so trying to help people make connections, right, at this time, and to be able to process what they need to do at this time and facilitate that and then support them through that.
Let's take another call. We've got James on the line in Kingston. James, join us.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm a nurse, and I'm working in an intensive care unit now, and we have all corona patients with us. And I just wanted to bring up that I think that there's a little concern with we're having people so critically ill, and many of them are dying. And I'm just worried about the loss of empathy from the nurses and doctors because, you know, it's happening so many patients, the volume's high. And the other thing is that usually the visitors and their emotions help trigger our emotions and personalize patients because we don't really know these patients. They're basically, many of them are strangers. But seeing the family and seeing the grief inside the family helps trigger our emotions also.
James, how are you? How are you faring?
I'm fine. I'm blessed. No problem there.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. Mm-hmm. Sari, we do get numb. We can get overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And when we do, when we become numb, we can lose our empathy. We can lose our compassion. What's your reaction to James's comments?
Yeah, James, you are really calling out something really profound and difficult and something that is on everyone's minds. You know, even before we were in the crisis we find ourselves in now with healthcare workers working 24/7 under the most incredible pressure and stress, our medical professionals don't get the support that they need. They don't get the support they deserve. They have a hard time reaching for that support. Even if it's available, there is a little bit of a desert here under normal circumstances. And under the pressure that the system finds itself in right now, it seems like part of what I hear you saying is the families bring the humanity. The mm-hmm. families help us remember who the human is in that bed, who the person is. And I think that it's a big ask. We are asking doctors and nurses and all of you medical personnel to provide all of the humanity and all of the care. And that is extraordinary. It's extraordinary. And it's mm-hmm. also a recipe that makes me think, how is anyone capable of doing that? Is that even possible? Mm-hmm. And I think we all kind of know the answer to that. It's, you know, it's an enormous ask. Everyone's doing mm-hmm. the best that they can, but compassion burnout is a real thing. And exhaustion and fear and terror, this is all real and needs to be acknowledged and said out loud. And people who are on the outside who are thinking, oh my gosh, is this doctor or nurse or, you know, is this person going to be too just exhausted to sit and hold my loved one's hand or to stroke their hair, to do whatever it is that I would like to do? And it's a terrifying question to have to ask.
So Reverend Kearns, I'm sorry, Siri, I didn't
mean
to interrupt you.
No.
Well, it's just Reverend Kearns, you're at the Brigham and Women's Hospital.
Right.
What we're hearing Siri say, I imagine you're seeing exactly that right now.
Yeah, I've had this kind of conversation this morning, that I really recognizing kind of the emotional burden that the nurses are carrying, and really recognizing in this time that patients, families, and friends provide so much support for the patients that really help nurses and doctors do their job and personalize people. They're absent, and just to have no one here on their behalf really turns a lot of that responsibility over to the clinicians. So there's really a mourning of the absence of them. And one of the things I'm concerned about is the nurses and clinicians having to carry the grief of the last one, you know, of the death, because they're there with them and the family isn't. And mm-hmm. so they're asked to do double duty. But, it really is quite painful. And one of the things I find myself doing more than often now is to provide support to the nurses, to go to the units and just talk to them and kind of process, what's this like for you right now? And it's messy. One nurse said, this is messed up. Mm-hmm. That, you know, this person is dying alone. Their family's not here. This is messed up.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Siri, we've got about a minute left, and I just want to ask you, what advice can you give to listeners about how to help people they know who are suffering or grieving right now?
Reach out and make yourself available in whatever format is comfortable for you, and respects the laws of social distancing. And, you know, if that's a phone call, if that's a FaceTime, if that's, you know, sending a little something in the snail mail is, you know, it's still available to us. And there's something so sweet about getting a little something in the mail. The point is to connect, and if that person doesn't want to connect, it's to offer the connection. Uh-huh. So that they know when they do want to grieve, you're there.
I'm going to take it back from you there, Siri. Thank you. That's fabulous advice. And that's Siri Luderman, a grief counselor based in Lexington. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Reverend John Kearns, a chaplain at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Thanks, Reverend Kearns.
You're welcome. We're here for anyone.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.